May it please the court.
You may proceed.
Each year,
could you shut that door in the hallway, please? Thank you.
Each year, we have to present a few lawyer discipline cases where we see no alternative to disbarment. Usually, as in this case, we ask for disbarment because the lawyer's misconduct was knowing and selfish, and because the lawyer benefited financially while his client, in this case at least two clients, suffered significant financial harm. When those levels of intent and harm come together, and when the misconduct is aggravated by offers of false evidence and other incredible explanations in defense, and empty promises to make restitution, and a complete failure to accept responsibility, in our view, that is that nothing less than disbarment can.
Well, there's a concept in tort law that if there's an intervening criminal act, that can somehow affect the tort. Isn't there an allegation there was an intervening criminal act that his wife stole from?
Well, that there's no criminal act yet because nobody has found anyone guilty of crime.
What if there were? Would that make a difference here? And is that a reason why we should delay?
Right, I shouldn't. It's not that easy. Right, it's not.
Is that a reason we should delay deciding this case until we find out if she is criminally convicted?
No.
Okay, then.
My short answer is no.
So that's a different answer to this question, then. Tell me what.
Well, first, the panel. I'll get there a second. Because even if the court believes not only that Mr. Ferris's wife is guilty, that doesn't make Mr. Ferris innocent. It may make him just as guilty. There's nothing that we know about the charge that there might be against his ex-wife that would excuse him of anything.
Is he being charged?
He has not yet been charged. He has a responsibility under the rules of professional conduct. The responsibility isn't excused. This court looked at a case, very similar case, in 1986, the Williams case. I don't think it's in your briefs, but it's in our response to his motion to remand that the court ruled on last week or so.
And of course he has a responsibility, and he's the one who's responsible, and if somebody stole and he wasn't overseeing them, he has a definite responsibility. But does that, and I'm not saying that's what occurred here, but if it did, doesn't that affect the mens rea, though? Because then it's different than committing fraud versus allowing fraud through recklessness to occur. And would that affect disbarment versus suspension?
If the court believed all of that and decided that then under the Williams case, there still could be a disbarment, which is what happened in that case, where also a wife who was the office manager.
And why is that? What is the mens rea that would justify disbarment in that situation?
Allowing it to happen.
So
knowing.
Recklessness. You have to know she's stealing. Well, sure, that would be.
Well, Williams didn't know she was stealing. He knew the thing. He knew.
Why
the
is that the right result? Tell me why that's right.
Okay. Because Mr. Ferris knew that something was horribly wrong. That's his explanation that he gave to the panel. He knew that his wife, just as Mr. Williams' wife, that there were overdrafts in the account. And he knew that he didn't have funds to pay his client the $31,000 check.
What was his wife's role in the firm?
She was listed as the chief operating officer.
And there is a 4-5.1 and 5.2, which is different from the general public.
Or 5.3 as well, right.
And 5.3 as well. That requires the lawyer to supervise, be responsible for the supervision of the people working in their office.
Right. But a lawyer can be guilty of something in a failure to supervise without having that charge. And that's the nature of was the nature of the charge in Williams, and is the nature of the, because the responsibility for maintaining books, the responsibility for honesty, continues in any event. It's not just a failure to supervise that is charged. And in fact, it's not charged here because the respondent argued against it and the panel agreed.
And the panel found there was more than simply failure to supervise, though they didn't actually find he stole the money, but they found his comments, his explanation not credible, and what all did they find about his state of mind?
Well, they did find that the evidence he offered was not believable. They found that he knowingly failed to maintain funds to pay his client's medical bills, that he knowingly failed to negotiate with the health care providers, the lien holders, that he engaged in, that he knowingly failed to produce records at our request. They found that he had a dishonest or selfish motive, and they found that he submitted false evidence. They said that they were not impressed with his explanations, and his testimony was generally questionable and bordering on disingenuous.
He says that he testified that he didn't know that the Skaggs Hospital wasn't paid and didn't know about the other medical providers not being paid. Did they find that not believable, those claims, or was that necessary for them to find?
They must have found that not believable. They didn't use those terms that you just used, but they found that he knew that he knowingly they said they did not believe his evidence that she acted without his knowledge.
Other than those two medical payment issues, were there other overdrafts, other things not paid, other improper uses of?
Right. The other client, the Daffenbaugh, which I think is the count two, was another. That one was just discovered during the OCDC examination of the trust account. That was another one where $90,000 came in for settlement, $30,000 went to fee, $32,000 went to the client, $28,000 was supposed to be held for the lien holders, for that other client, for Daffenbaugh. Those lien holders never got paid. Ms. Daffenbaugh didn't get her money back, and none of them have gotten any of their money back, either the...
Has he offered to correct his practices to come into compliance with the OCDC's requirements? Has he offered to change his practices?
Yeah, it does, Your Honor, thank you. I think there's some language like that in his testimony. You know, I'll try to do better. I won't. You know, he also promised to make restitution, but that hasn't happened. I mean, we're 3 or 4 years into it, and we've had no restitution. I mean, my guess, this sounds cynical, but my guess is there's been no restitution because he doesn't expect the court to believe him. And so there's no reason to go ahead and pay it. I mean, there's been no evidence.
How much money is still outstanding that he has to pay back?
Well, okay, to these two clients, 106 or so thousand, to either the one client or her lien holders, and to the other client, 28,000 is owed to either her lien holders or herself. Either way, the money's still not in the trust account, by the way. The other thing that the trust account examination revealed is that over a couple of year period, 111 transfers were made to the operating account, ranging from $1,000 to $20,000, with no memo to referring to any client. The transfers were made coinciding with the time when the operating account was in or near overdraft. So all of those things were happening at the same time as the money was being taken from the trust account, transferred to the operating account. All he would have had to do when he saw that this overdraft occurred to the one client, the $31,000 check that he wrote to her that bounced, all he would have had to do was just an instant look at the trust account. It wouldn't have required any serious reconciliation, because coming out of the trust account were these even numbered checks without any notation, 111 of them, and that if he'd have done that, he would have seen and been able to fix it quickly. But no effort has happened to that end during this whole 3 years or so since then.
Counsel, the panel was expressed some concern as to whether there were other clients who had been similarly harmed. What's your level of confidence that going back, looking backwards, that these are the two clients who suffered harm and that there aren't others?
I think the testimony of our examiner was that she did try to find more and didn't find any more to that end. Any more specific examples of clients who didn't get paid?
Did they go back?
We've disbarred people, of course, for one theft of less than $500.
Was that looking at the ins and outs during a certain year period from
yes.
the trust account? How far back?
Oh, a year or so, over a year. I mean, the panel found, again, as an aggravation, dishonesty, selfish behavior, no restitution, failure to provide records to us, failure to accept any responsibility. They found they found all those things, and in our view, they got it right. Their recommendation for sanction, of course, is less than what we think is appropriate. We think that a disbarment is essential at this time.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
I want to first acknowledge to this court that I understand and accept my responsibility in this. I had a duty to safeguard the client funds. I unfortunately delegated away or allowed that authority to delegate away. I know that Teddy Roosevelt once said you can delegate away authority but not responsibility. And I understand that and I acknowledge it. I should have not trusted a third-party non-attorney in my firm to have become the chief operating officer on charge of everything, including the trust account. I should have not allowed that. That said, I did, because I thought I could trust someone. I thought that my spouse of nearly 20 years, the mother of four children of mine, would be someone that I could trust. As it turns out, I could not. I'd like to go into a little bit of what Mr. Phillips just talked about, and that is he claims that the panel found that my conduct was knowing and selfish. There is nothing in the record that reflects that. In fact, what is in the record is the testimony of the informant's examiner. She testified specifically that she was unable to determine that respondent personally made any of the transfers. There was no evidence before the panel that respondent misappropriated any of the funds.
Counsel, Mr. Phillips makes the point that whether or not you physically did this, you had someone who was an office manager who was also your spouse who directly handled the money and the accounts. That doesn't mean you didn't know about it, and they found your explanations disingenuous.
Well, I will tell you that I did not know about it, and that was the evidence before the board, before the panel. I had health issues. This is established in the record. I had a pulmonary embolism, 25% chance of surviving it in 2010. Because of that and due to other reasons, my ex-spouse took over control of the administrative part of the practice, leaving me to practice law. I did not know of any of this. I had no idea. One of the other things that Mr. Phillips addressed is he said that I knew something was horribly wrong. That's not in the record whatsoever. There's nothing in the record to support that statement. That is
distinguishable. What about the fact that there were transfers in even numbered amounts and thousands of dollars without any notation to what particular client they applied to from the trust account to the operating account? Why can't we infer that if you had gone to the trouble to look, that the money would still be there, or that you would have tried to rectify it sooner?
Judge, your statement is accurate. If I had not placed the level of trust that I had placed in my spouse, and I thought I had a good reason to be able to do that, then I would have been part of that administrative process every month to have made sure that the transfers were done and they were proper. My role in it...
What gave you the confidence in your spouse? What expertise did she have, or what education is that area? What training? What gave you the I mean, whether it's your spouse or not, you had her doing this work. What gave you the confidence in her?
She basically used to work for her parents' business. They had a multi-million-dollar restaurant in Branson. She did all the administrative work in that restaurant. She basically ran the administrative part of that business. And to my knowledge, she ran a pretty tight ship, to my knowledge. And I think to a certain point, I think she did that. And at a certain point, something happened, something snapped. I don't understand to this day what happened.
But you're saying you were negligent or reckless even in failing to supervise and in relying on her but not knowing? Is that it? Because you recognize that you should have been looking at this and we're not. So that
I recognize that I should have been part of the reconciliation process.
So you were negligent, you were reckless, you knew you weren't doing it, but let it happen. What state of mind goes with that?
I think that I understand that I have a civil liability, and I believe that I should have been part of that process. Well, I wasn't.
But when Ms. Sisson's check bounced, she met with you. You knew it had bounced. You promised to pay her and reduce your fee. You didn't pay her. She still hasn't been paid.
Okay.
So how does that, I mean, that's not any level of negligence or recklessness. That's actual knowledge in that instance that the thing had come off the rails.
Let me explain that, and this is what was in the record. When Ms. Sisson called me and told me that that check had bounced, first of all, I wrote the check firmly believing that the funds were in there. That was not a role I was involved in, because usually, again, my wife was involved with that. My youngest son had some problems with seizures and some health issues. She was out of town during that time. I wrote the check fully believing. Why else would I have written the check? I wrote the check fully believing that some $31,000 was in the account. When she told me, I asked my wife about it. She said, oh, I got confused with all this stuff going on with our son. I actually thought you told me to go ahead and write. We did have conversations about the fact that there was a certain amount of money that was being held in account because we were going to be trying to figure out issues related to the medical bills. She told me at that time, she provided me at that time, that $66,000 check that she purported to me had already been written out to the hospital.
But even under that explanation, you should have had money in your trust account for that money that was due the hospital plus the money that was due your client. There should have been enough in to pay everybody, so you had to know something was wrong because there wasn't money to pay, because that was not your money. There was supposed to be money from the settlement in the account for paying doctors and for paying the client, and you just said you should explain why there wasn't enough for the client because you paid some other responsibilities.
Actually, the breakdown of funds, Your Honor, is Ms. Sisson got $50,000 right up front.
Counsel, you're saying you owed her money and you owed the hospital money. Out of that, you didn't have enough to pay both. That was your wife's explanation for why it was an insufficient funds check.
No, the funds that were to be in the account was the sum of $66,000. That was the grand total after a payment that had been made to Ms. Sisson and the fee that had been received by the firm. The actual funds that were to be in the account was the $66,000. So when she gave me the check showing me that she had paid that out, then by all means...
You're saying she overpaid. You thought she'd overpaid the medical providers.
No. She told me, okay, when you do all the math, you find $66,000 is the amount that was still in the trust account. It was supposed to have been still in the trust account.
And how much was owed the medical providers?
The medical providers in total was about $100,000.
So why didn't you have the money in the account to pay them?
Well, what we were planning to do was, she had not heard from the hospital for years about this bill. I knew from the history of the hospital, going through a change, that some of the accounts they were letting go. I had talks with her, this is all on the record, about the fact she was hopeful we could negotiate the bills significantly down from past history dealing with the providers that had happened.
How much was the settlement amount that you got?
$197,000.
Okay. Why wasn't there enough in there to pay out of that The amount owed the medical providers and the amount owed your client?
When you take $197,000 and you subtract from that about $80,000 that was a fee earned by the firm on a 40%.
You don't get that until you pay the other expenses. You took your money out but didn't have enough to pay her or the doctors?
When the recovery was received, the firm took the fee because that was the contingency fee was upon recovery. Okay, so you have the 80, you have the 50. What's left from that is this $66,000. So when she gave me that check, which then later in the process, believing that check was accurate, I forwarded it along to Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel. Now the record is also clear that when there was an advisory committee meeting in, I believe, November of 2012, that, and it was uncontradicted before the panel, that when they told me for the first time, I attended that meeting, when they told me for the first time that that check had never appeared anywhere, had not gone through the account, had not received by the hospital, the informant's counsel, Randy Stimmons, told me that the look on my face was that of shock, and that is accurate. It was of shock. So if the informant's own counsel, her own feedback was that I was shocked to hear that, then doesn't that in fact support the finding that I had no idea of any of this happening?
I think. Did you ever explain to your client that there was after you took your $80,000, there was $66,000 left, that was not enough money to pay the medical bills, and she wasn't going to get any money?
Let me address that, and I think it's a follow-up to an earlier question also. I met with Ms. Sisson with my ex-wife. We met with her. My ex-wife explained to her what she did, and she told her she paid the medical bills. She gave her a copy of the check. I told her, I said, listen, your medical bills, those were paid. They were accepted by the hospital. That was my understanding. What I did with her, I want to make sure it's clear, I've always had a policy that it shouldn't be something that an attorney should receive a greater fee in a personal injury type claim than the net recovery of the client. At that point, she'd received 50, I had received, I think, some like 80. I reduced my fee, paid her that difference, so that I think she could come to like some $66,000 in pocket and reduce my fee down to $65,000. Did that answer your question, Judge?
Yes.
Okay. I want to address the issue of restitution. First of all, Mr. Phillips gave you a number much higher than the amount of restitution. The amount of restitution is a number of approximately $93,000. It's the $66,000 that was from Ms. Sisson, and it's a remaining $27,000 on the Doppelbach case. I made application to cash out my life insurance policy to pay out approximately $68,000, which was held in the life insurance policy. That $68,000, that life insurance policy, has gotten tied up in the middle of the divorce case. I do refer to her as being my ex-spouse because an interlocutory judgment of dissolution was entered. We are set for trial in front of Judge McPherson on January 9th. To my knowledge, no one anymore is arguing that those funds should be released and be paid over to the clients or to OCDC to be able to distribute to the clients. Those funds, I believe, will be ordered. That's my intention. That's, I think, actually to her benefit. My ex-spouse is trying to get those funds paid over as well because she is, in fact, being prosecuted for two Class B felony counts of stealing. By the way, on that, she's been bound over. This court can take judicial notice that a court of this state has found probable cause to believe that she fraudulently stole that money. I think that's important.
Have you agreed to testify against her?
Yes. I was subpoenaed at the preliminary hearing. I was prepared to testify. I cooperated. I was interviewed by law enforcement, and I was prepared to testify. The judge actually went ahead and found probable cause, like some six witnesses. There were 17 witnesses. He didn't even get to the last six before he found probable cause.
Did you receive immunity? Evidence. Did you see immunity from the from prosecution?
I did not.
Assuming that the proceeds from your life insurance policy are paid over, what about the balance that you owe in restitution? What are your plans on that?
Your Honor, what I propose to the court, what I propose to the panel, and I think what's appropriate in this case, if you look at the last 3 years, as cited in my brief, there have been at least 14 different cases involving trust account violations in which those individuals received an opportunity for a stay of otherwise discipline. I think my case fits within that case. If you would grant me a stay and place me on a two-year probation, that remaining $25,000 would be paid during the term of that probation. If you want it on a faster time schedule, then I'll make that happen.
And what wouldn't it be more believable if you'd made at least some payments over the last year or two towards restitution instead of waiting to see how this came out?
Well, I mean, the reality is that because of this, because of the criminal case, my practice unfortunately dwindled down to a certain point. There's a lot of people who are kind of waiting in the wings right now. I do have very important cases. I'm actively practicing law. I have very important cases to move forward to representing clients. I think the largest thing is the divorce case. We've gone through seven different judges in my divorce case. Seven judges have either recused or just left the case, including a judge who just walked out of the middle of a hearing last October. So this case has been pending, the divorce case, for 18 months. That's tied up everything, unfortunately. But I do plan to move forward. You asked Mr. Phillips earlier about my arrangements and what arrangements have I made to rectify. I have made those arrangements. I've taken, first of all, control administratively and financially of my own practice. I unfortunately had allowed that to be out of my control. I've controlled it. There are certain things that were being done unbeknownst to me, such as, for a while, certain credit card fees, evidently under my wife's control, were being taken out of the account because of charging fees. I rectified that. I'm doing all the things. I've studied the things. I'm committed during a two-year probation, if you grant that, to do everything, to come up with an office management plan, to have a mentor.
What were you doing before you got sick and your wife took over?
I had control of the office, and quite frankly, I did a very, very good job of it. In fact, before the record, was a case that the largest personal injury contingency case that I settled was $700,000. Every single penny of that was properly accounted for and distributed. I took care of all that.
Counsel, and so if the court chose to do something different, something more harsh than a two-year suspension, then what's your plans for restitution?
I'm still committed to pairing January 9th and asking those $68,000 in the life insurance be distributed.
But okay? Beyond that, the extra $20,000.
Beyond that, I will do whatever I can to work my tail off, quite frankly, to be able to come up with those funds and pay the restitution.
Okay. It's not contingent on the court giving
it. It is not at all, Your Honor.
Okay.
It is not.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I asked the court to try to track the math and look at the panel's pretty hard questioning of Mr. Ferris about the math and realize that his explanations about how it came to pay $31,000 of bounce check to one to his client and then $66,000 to the hospital, really, the math just doesn't track. I mean, none of it makes sense.
The panel actually found that he had not negotiated for any reduction and settlement of the health care bills. Is that right?
Right. And the hospital wasn't the only lien holder. The others, there were no good or bad checks that went to them, no effort to communicate with them. There were no records of any communication at all with any of the lien holders. He actually initially at the deposition said, I'd lost the file, both files, but then did show up with two letters at the hearing to the hospital.
If there had been no negotiations of the health care bills, was that considered, or did the DHP reference that as to believability that the $66,000 went to satisfy their claim?
I don't think they did that in their findings. If you read their questioning, the two lawyers on there are 30-year litigators. And you can see that in their questioning more than even in the disciplinary counsel's questioning. So you can see it in their questioning, the doubt, but I didn't see it in the findings itself.
Counsel, he says that the record would show that all this occurred in the short time frame when his wife was managing his accounts, and there's no evidence of any improprieties prior to that or after that. Is that accurate?
Well, there's no evidence one way or the other. That's accurate.
But is that important for us to know? Is that relevant to his credibility of his explanations for during that period?
You know, he talked about his health because it relating the same time too. His doctor testified as a character witness, and the counsel for the informant asked him, well, was he competent and fit to practice during this time? He said, yes, he was representing me in my case during that
but
time.
But his point was that lessen the burden on him. He had his wife take over the administrative matters. Was that found just not to be a credible explanation? Or is it before, I'm just asking a simple question, if it was only during that period where that occurred and he said it was after he had this health issue, is that relevant to our consideration of the intent with which this was done and whether it was a knowing part of it?
It could be, but he didn't raise anything. He didn't raise it in that fashion. I mean, he certainly didn't try to apply Rule 5.285 and talk about his fitness or anything like that.
You did indicate that your investigator examined his records for a year before and found no improprieties.
Well, I won't say that at all. I'm sorry. I hope I didn't leave that impression. It was difficult to find any other clients who were harmed. Over that period, there were, as I mentioned, 111 transfers from the trust account to the operating account without any notation.
If you didn't want to get caught, would it be a legitimate strategy to minimize the people that you didn't pay in full?
I'm sorry. Try that again.
If you didn't want to get caught,
right?
In using your trust account for personal business, would it be a legitimate strategy to minimize the people that you didn't pay? In other words, you said there were 111 transactions without a memo.
Right.
There seems to be two people with hundreds, over $100,000 that had money taken from them.
Yes. I don't want to spread that word, but yes. I'd rather not use the term legitimate strategy, but a potential strategy that somebody might use that was hoping not to get caught would be not even use the trust account for that matter.
The disciplinary hearing panel found that shifting the blame to his spouse was not a mitigating factor.
Was not a mitigating factor.
Right. Do you agree with that?
Right. If anything, it's an aggravating, I would argue, because if we also don't believe him, then, you know, transferring blame is certainly not accepting responsibility.
What about the health issues?
The health issues, his doctor said he was fit enough to represent him. You know, I know there's no question that he had tough times, but we have a rule for that, and we allow the lawyers to present evidence to that.
He wasn't saying he was incompetent or unable to practice. That's not what his health issues were. He was explaining why he had his wife take over the business end of his law business. He wasn't saying because he wasn't competent to practice law, but because it was too much. So the rule regarding inability to practice has nothing to do with it. He was explaining why he let her do it, and he didn't have reason to think she wouldn't do it properly.
Well, if it's offered in mitigation at all, then there has to be some support for it.
Well, it's offered as to why it's not just an excuse, something made up, that this was how he happened to have someone take it over. Now, we can believe that or not believe that, but it was it after his health problems that then she took over? She had not done it previously?
That I don't know. I don't think it's in the record.
What's the timing of when his health problems started versus
I think the time probably matches, right.
So okay. Do we not believe that? Why do we think she took over and the problems?
I still don't think it matters because he still had a responsibility, and
but
he acknowledged.
But that's the difference in doing it yourself versus simply abdicating his responsibility, which is also a violation. They're very different violations.
They are different, but if the court goes back and looks at Williams' case, and I know it was a long time ago, the court found because he knew enough to do something about it. In that case, he knew it in advance. In this case, even if we buy everything he tells us, he knew it as soon as he found something, and the record does reflect I knew something was horribly wrong. As soon as he saw that and took no action, then and hasn't fixed it since.
So you're saying even if he wasn't initially a part of it, when he saw the CISN check bounced and so forth, he didn't do anything.
Didn't even go look and see that there was money going out every day or every other day from his trust account without any reference. Didn't even look at that CISN account or the check to make sure that it was even presented. I mean, made no effort, even under his own explanation. So under the, because of all that, we believe that disbarment is the appropriate sanction in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under submission.